I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about whatever's in the news and whatever's on their minds. In the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, Professor Lester Spence, columnist Roland Martin, and Ruben Navarrete, a syndicated columnist. I may jump in, but for now, take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, fellas. Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Great.
Oh, chilling.
All right, well, check this out. The Mitchell Report, which aims to reveal the serious drug culture in baseball, is posted on the internet for all to see. Now, Rolly Roll, Roland Martin, this is your first time in the barbershop. Welcome. How is this going to shake up baseball going forward?
First of all, it's going to benefit Barry Bonds the most. Barry Bonds has gotten all of the attention over the past 2 years. And so all of a sudden, now when you have other potential Hall of Fame guys like Roger Clemens now being implicated, now these other sports writers who love dissing Barry are going to have to somehow criticize their favorite boy, Roger Clemens. So I can't wait to see what they say about him and Miguel Tejada and these other guys who they've been heaping praise on all these years.
I see. So now the criticism gets spread around. Lester?
Yeah, I think Roland's right. And what I actually like to see happen, I don't think this will, but what I actually like to see happen is actually somebody, at least somebody, make the argument that given the pervasive use of this among baseball's best athletes and best players, that perhaps we should actually move towards some type of legalization and regulation. Because it's not just about using steroids to hit the ball faster. You have to remember these guys are playing 162-game seasons, and probably at least some of them are using it to actually extend their careers rather than necessarily to get a competitive edge over their guys.
That's a really interesting point. Ruben, legalize it?
No, I don't think so. I think that where the debate is going to go is over this idea of privacy and over this whole notion of whether or not the name should have been published at all. And I really think that's the wrong debate to have. I mean, if in fact, as Roland pointed out, it's okay to take someone like Barry Bonds and drag his name through the mud for something similar and raise questions about whether or not he should have an asterisk next to his name in the record books, then why isn't it okay to put other people up there and let them likewise be up to the sort of same public scrutiny? So
I understand what you're saying, but I also feel like Barry Bonds, whether we like it or not, has been subjected to a law enforcement proceeding. I mean, he's been brought before a grand jury.
Right.
And
right.
So that's a public fact, even though the grand jury testimony itself is supposed to be secret. But I don't know. I mean, if you were one of these guys,
well, I mean, the bottom line is no one can point to Barry Bonds ever failing a test. Same thing with a lot of these players. So you're sitting here saying, wait a minute, you're putting me out on Front Street. I never failed a test. And in many ways.
Yeah, but Roland, the whole point is to evade failing a test. I mean, that's part of the game.
But also part of the game on the owner's standpoint is to turn the other way because you want to get paid. You know, so bottom line is, if the owners want to get paid, the general managers want to get paid, we're sitting here dogging the athletes. Yeah. That's why I appreciate at least this report is blaming all of baseball.
Yeah, it's systemic. It's systemic. And that's why I brought up the idea of legalization.
I think we have to have a conversation in general about these athletes being lifted up as role models as opposed to us as parents. Being role models, because there's another athlete, Michael Vick. He's been sentenced to 23 months in prison for his role in a dogfighting operation.
Okay, so you know I'm out of this one, right?
Oh, you got a dog or something?
No.
No. Actually, she has a dog in this fight.
I have a dog in this fight.
I know this, man.
Cousin Martin. Okay, but I'll step out of the shop, gentlemen. I'll let you all talk.
Ain't no problem.
Listen, Lester, was the punishment too harsh or not harsh enough?
Well, the punishment would have been lighter had he actually owned up, not lied. I think he failed a drug test, you know, said that he hadn't been using drugs. And there are a couple other things that he actually said he was doing or wasn't doing and got caught lying about. So it's really hard to make a case when you've done all that stuff. So to that extent, I mean, 24 months, he probably should have gotten more. But, you know, we'll see.
Let me go far as guns.
Roland?
Stupid is as stupid does.
Yeah. That's
when
right.
Your butt in trouble,
yep,
and you got the most to lose,
yeah,
you should be running your mouth like a faucet. Look at here. We got to cut a deal. Let me get in front of this thing. How you going to sit here knowing full well you have pleaded guilty? You're going to fail a drug test.
All right, fellas. We're on to another dog fight. Check this out. Democratic presidential candidates Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are tied up, polling at a dead heat in New Hampshire. But if Hillary fights back, will she lose her black supporters? Ruben,
yo,
how will the liberals respond?
They are not doing well. I'll tell you this. White liberals like African-Americans in the role in which they've cast them, and that is a supporting role. white liberals are supposed to carry the ball, and when they get in trouble, they're going to go to the black community, and they're going to count the black community to support them. And black community has been very, very loyal to white liberals, including especially Bill Clinton, the former president, and according to Toni Morrison, America's first black president. But in this case, what you have is Barack Obama actually wants to be a player, and he's leading Hillary Clinton in Iowa. He's tied with her effectively in New Hampshire. And now the spotlight's on white liberals to see how they're going to react. And I got to tell you, brother, they are not reacting well. Let me just cut to the chase. All the stuff they threw at Barack Obama, I'm going to give you the worst one. This week, Bill Sheehan, her co-chairman up in New Hampshire, was talking to a reporter from the Washington Post. And he basically said, you can't put forward Barack Obama as the party's nominee because he's flawed. Republicans will pull out all these dirty tricks, like they'll bring up his past drug use, you know, that's actually Barack has put that out already. What's the big deal with that? But wait, it gets worse. At that point, Sheehan said, yeah, you know, I can imagine Republicans asking questions like, did you sell drugs to anyone? Okay, time out.
Right.
Because during that whole conversation with Bill Clinton back in 92, when we talked about drugs and he said, I didn't inhale, nobody suggested that Bill Clinton was a drug dealer. Do you think it's a coincidence that the first time you have an African-American top-tier candidate running for president, a white liberal brings up the notion of them being a drug dealer? I'm not sure. Very bad.
Well,
L. Spence.
What I'm more interested in is that there are a number of people who are talking about that black people didn't support Obama at first because black people didn't feel it was black enough. Some people actually made the idiotic comment that black people didn't love themselves enough. But what this really shows is black people, I think, are some of the most sophisticated voters in America, and they've been that way. When Obama first hit, they wanted to see how he rolled, and now they actually like what they see. They're shifting their preference. That's actually the story.
But the story, though, is here you have a cat who is the son of a former governor of New Hampshire, who is the co-chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign in New Hampshire, making this comment when Obama has cut her lead down to 2 points in New Hampshire. The Clinton campaign is running scared. They came out swinging. They've thrown all kind of stuff out, and he's had this momentum, and they've been trying everything. She goes negative. It bounced. They tried the gender card. She got nailed for it. Then they went after him and his whole issue writing an essay in kindergarten. I'm like, oh, come on. I mean, that's what you got going on.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that the story isn't important. It is interesting, and he's going to get canned, and what happened to Senator Clinton is going to happen to her. But for me, what's interesting is just that shift in black support and how people are going to pitch that, because it kind of turns
on
its head.
But the shift is coming because many black folks were saying, I don't think white folks are going to vote for Obama. He's leading in Iowa.
Roland, how do we know this isn't just residual Oprah effect? How do we know this just isn't a feel-good surge?
Because the surge started 3 weeks before Oprah.
Yeah.
This has been building after her first stumble in that debate, and he's been rolling ever since. And so now,
and because she's unlikable. She is unlikable.
There you
and
when
go. She does stuff like this, she comes off unlikable. The one thing that her husband has that she does not have and she can't manufacture is likability.
Yep.
He actually enjoys people. I don't think she enjoys people, and she resents having run for president. She wants to be coronated president.
But
and it's coming across. And Obama is lapping it up because everybody likes Obama.
It's not just likability, but it's that her politics are bad.
Hold on, guys, for just a minute. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're in the barbershop for a weekly visit with Jimmy Israel, Ruben Navarrete, Roland Martin, and Lester Spence. And one thing, Lester said Bill Sheehan was going to resign from the Clinton campaign. Just to clarify, of course, he did resign. But, guys, I wanted to bring up something else. I wanted to bring up the number of births to unmarried women. Help me out here, Jimmy. The rate of unmarried women giving birth
has increased, according to the report from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, Roland wrote a little bit about that on CNN.com. Bro.
Well, the reason it's interesting, of course, is that people say, well, the reason I say policies is that folks say, well, gee, is this arising because, you know, abstinence-only education is so dominant now. But in fact, you see the biggest increase is women in their 20s.
First of all, you got several things to get inside of the numbers, really, in terms of who the folks having these kids. You know, is it 20-something, is it 30-something, or 40-something, in terms of people who are thinking, you know what, I'd rather raise a child on my own than the whole notion. Because you also have to look at the fact that the numbers are showing that people are getting married later in life, both men and women, especially African-Americans. It does become an issue, though, when it comes to that child having balance in terms of a mother and a father. My wife and I don't have any kids, but we've raised at different times 6 of my nieces. And 2 of them still live in my home in Texas. And because I've been so busy this year with my 5 jobs, they like, you know what, we haven't seen much of Uncle Roro. You know, is he going to come home more often? You know, these are young girls, the mother's raising them. They're still wanting my male presence. And so that is a concern there. So the question is, these unmarried women are having kids, but what's the male presence there so that child is getting that balance in terms of father and mother?
What I'm curious about, Roland, is what role do single mothers take in their own lot? I mean, as far as I know, you know, they still got a family planning center at every drugstore, and all that good stuff is mad cheap. It's less expensive than a hair relaxer. What's up with that?
But you got to get inside the numbers. You can say, here are the stats, increase in unmarried women having children. It always goes back to why. Are they having children because they want to have children?
Yeah.
Or are they having children, it was sort of an accident? If you have increasing women who are saying, I'm having children because I want to.
Right.
Or is the issue that, let's just break it down, because many of these women feel that the potential marriage partners are not there.
Right.
Lester.
Yeah,
Lester.
So the first thing I thought of, I actually checked out one of Roland's pieces about it. First thing I thought of is that the younger, particularly the younger folks, access to, you know, the health stuff may be inexpensive, but that doesn't necessarily mean they have access if they don't have knowledge about it. But the other thing is, I'd like to see us have a larger conversation about what sets of policies can we generate to make those who choose to have kids without fathers to make their lives better and to make the lives of those kids better.
Lester, you're talking about ignorance. You know, I mean, they teach the birds and the bees in sixth grade health class, bro. So everybody knows about birth control. Ruben, jump in here, please.
Yo, I mean, this is a problem. This is something that will always come back to haunt the Black community, the white community, to some degree the Latino community, because there needs to be more stigma attached to this kind of behavior, to having children outside of wedlock. There needs to be a stigma.
Because it's not cool to be a baby
mama. Why? Because it's not a good
thing. Why not?
It's not a good thing. But most importantly, it's not a good thing for the kid because
no,
as people have laid out,
cool.
Being
sounds,
a
no,
single sounds, mother
that sounds
is
more
not
like,
cool, bro.
Because of poverty.
That sounds more like liberal gobbledygook. I mean, the issue here is not that people don't have money. The issue here is whether kids are going to have two parents. And I think we've become way too permissive and way too accommodating to folks. And we should just say, this is not a kind of behavior we want to encourage more of. There should be some kind of
absolutely.
Stigma
but
attached to it.
Hold on. Right. But again, though, I think we got to go back
ahead,
to, again,
Roland.
Why somebody's having a kid.
Yeah.
If there's a single woman who has a job, she has means, and she says, you know what, one, I don't want to get married, but I do want to have a kid. She can take care of her child. But it's an issue when you're a teenager or you're another single person.
I'm sorry. I know more people who say, I would like to get married, but there are no suitable partners out here for me.
Right.
And
I'm
in the absence of a suitable partner, I don't want to be childless.
So what Ruben is saying is those people shouldn't have kids. So we can say that lawyers having kids without fathers are okay, then the only thing that distinguishes that lawyer from that mother in that 75% category is poverty.
If a woman in that case says that she's walking through the process, as Michelle said, I don't see a suitable partner, I don't want to be childless, she has thought through the process, she's walked through it.
That's right.
The issue is when it comes up somebody who hasn't done that, who all of a sudden lays down with somebody and gets pregnant and then they're having a kid.
Well, look, I just appreciate hearing you all grapple with this. But speaking with grappling with something seriously, there's something I wanted to raise. I was hoping I could take a minute. I wanted to bring up an email, which is representative of some of the mail we've gotten in recent weeks about the barbershop. And a number of our conversations, particularly about politics, a couple of you, I don't want to call names, but you all know who you are, have kind of been a little tough on the traditional civil rights leaders. This is a subject that's come up a couple of times. And so this is what one listener had to say. Listening to these young brothers is comparable to the sound of fingernails grating across a blackboard. Personally, I find it bothersome that these young men who probably never fought for anything and by birth alone inherited the benefits of the civil rights movement without shedding blood, sweat, or tears can joke and disrespect older leaders like Jesse Jackson Sr. and Al Sharpton. Our communities are in critical condition. At least Jesse and other older African Americans are putting their energy and effort toward rallying Black ministers and churches to get tested for AIDS, helping people keep their homes. And it goes on from there. I'll delete the part where she talked about how you all are sitting in the Starbucks sipping your expensive lattes over your expensive laptops while they're out there fighting for the people. But you get the drift.
It sounds familiar because if she studies her history, she'll see that when now the folks who we refer to as the baby boomers, people who are in their 50s and 60s and coming into 60, when they were coming up, they likewise had that same sort of generational friction with the generation before them. And now when people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton are getting it from below, from younger folks, suddenly they're more inclined to yell foul. Now, I plead guilty. I have in the past referred to Jesse and Al as grievance merchants. Grievance merchants. They make their money out of making other people feel bad and yelling
not
foul.
Like, not like some, you, Ruben.
And I'm here to make people feel good. I'm here to uplift everybody. See, so
yes, sir.
It's the difference. And so, you know, when there's a scandal at Pepsi-Cola, Jesse Jackson's going to be the first one there to see if he can profit from it somehow.
You know,
Jimmy?
What? For me,
final
as a
word
writer
to you.
And culture commentator, you know, I call down that stuff that, you know, you've just been taking just for granted. You just refuse to question. You know, I'm trying to convince people of all colors, but certainly my folks, to think for themselves. And that's my gig. You either dig it or you don't. It's hard, but it's fair. My name is Jimmy Israel, and I approve this message. And with that, thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming to the shop, fellas. I got to kick it to one of my favorite people. Happy holidays. Michelle Martin.
Happy holidays to you. It's hard, but it's fair, Jimmy Israel. Jimmy Israel is a freelance writer. He joined us from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. Ruben Navarrete writes for the San Diego Union-Tribune and CNN.com. He joined us from KPBS in San Diego. Roland Martin is an author, commentator, and host. He joined us in our studios here in Washington. And Dr. Lester Spence is an assistant professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. He joined us from his office in Baltimore. You can find links to all of our barbershop guests at our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Yep.